You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 24th of April 2024 on Monocle Radio.
The UK's Foreign Secretary solicits the hearts and minds of Central Asia. The UK's Prime Minister promises a boost to understaffed armed forces and what not to do when bitten by a snake. I'm Andrew Muller. The Monocle Daily starts now. Hello and welcome to the Monocle Daily, coming to you from our studios here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Muller. My guests Terry Stiassny and Bill Hayton will discuss the day's big stories, and we'll meet the Helsinki Roasters, who believe that AI can brew you a better espresso. Stay tuned, all that and more coming up right here on the Monocle Daily. This is the Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller, and I am joined today by Terry Stiassny, the political journalist and author, and by Bill Hayton, Associate Fellow for the Asia-Pacific Programme at Chatham House. Hello to you both.
Hello.
Bill, first of all, as regular listeners may be aware, you are at one remove on a path to power. How is it going?
Path to power, yeah. The path to power is kind of paved with an awful lot of leaflets, I have to say.
This is on behalf of your wife?
My wife, who will one day be the premier of Colchester or something like that, the MP for Colchester. All being well, the electorate permitting.
The MP for Colchester may be only the start, Bill. You could be the Dennis Thatcher of about the 2040s.
I live in hope.
How is the leafleting going? Are you actually knocking on people's doors and asking them to vote for the missus?
Yes. And, well, you know, not overtly. You have to ask them, of course, you know, what issues they would like to raise. And most, 9 times out of 10, when you sort of, people come to the door in whatever they're wearing and you ask them, what are they concerned about? They either go from the potholes in the road, mm-hmm. and then you say, is there anything else? And then they just go, everything. And there's a kind of, it's very hard to sort of find a middle ground.
That escalates fast.
Yeah. It's not like sort of, I would like to see a rewrite of a particular policy. It's like, everything in the world is wrong. Could you fix that, please? Or the potholes. You know, just take your pick.
I mean, start with the potholes.
Yeah.
Work your way up. Terry, you have recently been or are about to attend reunions of one sort or another. Do you actually enjoy these things, or do you find them as mortifying as normal people do?
No, I do. The one I'm really looking forward to is the one of the people who I trained with at the BBC, which will be 30 years ago this year. And we all live in all sorts of different places around the world, whether it's like Paris or Sydney or Bristol, and so we're all actually meeting up in London, and so it will actually be fun, because there is normally lots and lots of gossip to catch up on and lots of reminiscing about embarrassing things we did when we were young trainee journalists.
I tried to get on that scheme about 30 years ago and I failed, so these are all the people
you can come along and point and laugh and say, what did I hire you for?
I mean, apart from Bill, obviously, Terry, roughly what percentage of this gathering do you think you will be able to lord it over?
Oh, no, none.
Really?
We're all, you know...
why go? Are you not understanding the...
Because we actually quite like each other.
Really?
Yeah.
That had simply
not
occurred to me.
None of us are still left at the BBC.
As a point to going to reunions. I thought it was all about the lording it over.
No, not necessarily. It's like we'll all actually be in the same place at the same time for a change. And yeah, we like each other. And I think perhaps if all of us were massively successful, if we were all, you know, really,
you're a panellist on the Monocle Daily, Terry.
Well, I know. I'll be able to go in and tell them that.
I would certainly open with that. We will start, however, with the current peregrinations of David Cameron, who is visiting Central Asia, Tajikistan, Kyrgyzstan, Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan, and Mongolia. Had he made this trip roughly 8 years ago, it might have been interpreted as some penitent pilgrimage undertaken in the hope that everybody would have forgotten about Brexit by the time he returned, or if not, that his beard would have grown long enough to spare him being pelted with expired groceries in the street. In 2024, however, he travels as Lord Cameron, Foreign Secretary, on a mission to, it says here, increase engagement with this pivotal region of the world. Terry, is he just making the most of the plane while he still has one?
He does seem to be making pretty good use of his plane. I've got to say, he does seem to be actually going and visiting places. And I think the interesting thing about this is looking at this visit. He is the first ever British Foreign Secretary to visit three of these countries, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan.
That leapt out at me, and that's an extraordinary dereliction.
And also the Foreign Affairs Committee at the end of last year were saying, look, there is a lack of seriousness in Britain's engagement with Central Asia. And they put in their report a table of, you know, which countries, Germany, France, UK, which countries have sent visits, have had people come and visit. And Britain was just like sort of nobody. And if you compare Britain's engagement with other European countries, and that's, of course, not even mentioning Turkey or China or Russia, it has just been massively lacking. So I think, you know, he's finally got around to doing this. And, you know, good for him, I think.
Bill, all jokes at Cameron's expense aside, this does seem like something a UK foreign secretary should be doing. And I did want to ask, given that this is very much or at least adjacent to your particular bailiwick, is it still a big deal in these countries when the Foreign Secretary of the United Kingdom, former Prime Minister, does turn up in person?
Yeah, I think it is for precisely this reason, that that people haven't been paying attention and all of a sudden they don't. And I guess it's, you know, it is quite clunky, and it's like, oh, we have a problem with Russia and we have a problem with China in Europe, so let's go and talk to the countries in the middle who are also ambivalent about their relations with Russia and China. And he's been sort of quite overt that this, you know, if you want to compete in the world, you've got to get out there and compete. He made a little sort of video and put it on Twitter about that. So I guess he is our man for the stands. I'm reminded that
you worked on that for some time.
There's an American guy I know who calls himself the man for the stands. I think the first British Foreign Secretary to go to Mongolia was Malcolm Rifkind. And I once found myself in a conversation with Malcolm Rifkind about his trip to Mongolia. And he said, because he made a point, he said, of when he was going somewhere, that he would try and go somewhere on the way back that a British Foreign Secretary hadn't been. So he went to Japan and he stopped in Mongolia. And he started his speech and he had a big reception. And he said, Britain and Mongolia have so much in common. And then he was sort of obviously desperately thinking what the next time was going to be. And he said, Attila the Hun never got to Britain and we never invaded Mongolia.
that is something you should probably plan somewhat further in advance. But to just follow up on the point you were making about engagement with this region, Bill, these countries do have ambivalent relationships with Russia and China, true, but how much hope is there of the UK and the wider West sort of like enticing them into our camp? Because geography does obviously dictate destiny to an extent, and they are right next to Russia and China, and that's probably not going to change.
No, I don't think they're going to move. But they definitely do want options. I mean, Mongolia explicitly has what it calls a third neighbour policy. It only has two actual neighbours, but it's constantly reaching out and it wants other countries to take an interest. If anyone's interested, I am moderating a round table on Mongolia's foreign relations for the Royal Society for Asian Affairs.
Who would not be interested in that?
I think everybody listening to this programme will be interested.
I mean, have the Metropolitan Police been advised? I anticipate scenes akin to those outside Buckingham Palace when the Beatles turned up to collect their MBEs.
It's online only, but I'm sure we'll be, you know,
When is this and how do people find it?
It's the 8th of May, and the Royal Society for Asian Affairs are hosting it. So they want options, clearly they don't want to be, you know, put into China's camp or Russia's camp. They want, you know, what international relations people call strategic autonomy. They want, you know, the freedom to be able to make their choices. And they are alarmed, you know, by Russia's moves in invasion of Ukraine. I mean, they very much are. They have not come out in support. They have to obviously to steer a careful course. And they don't want to be dragged into it. And they don't want to be, you know, once again be, as they would see it, colonized by Russia. So, you know, they are very well, you know, welcoming, I think, to, you know, to all kinds of visitors.
Terry, as an observer of British politics, what have you made of Cameron as Foreign Secretary generally? Because he was a surprise appointment. I think he clearly understood that he is here for a good time, not a long time. But has anything he's done or said surprised you? I mean, I've spoken myself in people I have coincidentally met who work in the Foreign Office, and I think they seem quite surprised to the extent that they are wistfully wondering if there is any possible way after the general election they might be able to keep him.
Well, I think that, you know, I mean, it's you can't really imagine a Labour government doing that.
You cannot imagine that happening.
You know, you can kind of see the way in which, you know, people might think that. Because if you look at, you know, some of the previous incumbents have not been impressive. I mean, if you think if you've had Boris Johnson, you've had Liz Truss, I think the diplomats were just, you know, I think James Cleverly, diplomats got on with him fairly fine and he seemed to certainly enjoy the job and they kind of liked having him around. But I think Cameron, he's also good at communicating it, and he always was. And if you sort of looked at that, you know, the video he did, you know, he was like sort of TV natural walking through NATO headquarters saying, you know, I'm going to do this, I'm off to go and do that. Okay, I'm going to go to America and try and persuade them to, you know, give more money to Ukraine. Okay, he didn't get the meeting with the speaker that he was promising when he was talking about it in the video, but he made a really good case, and you can see how he can be quite persuasive and how, because he doesn't have to bother with, you know, appearing in front of the House of Commons, and he doesn't really have to bother with British domestic politics to any great extent, that actually frees him up to actually do the job.
Just to pivot off this one slightly, Bill, US Secretary of State Anthony Blinken also attempting to engage with China. I don't know how much coordination there is between Washington and London on these things, but is there an opportunity for, well, for not just the United Kingdom, but the wider West to engage with these Central Asian countries and sort of do some kind of end around China, as it were? Is there more opportunity for being more ambitious?
Yes, I think there's an opportunity. I think there's, you know, a desire for engagement from the other side, but I just think that China's, you know, sheer economic heft and physical position means that no one is going to sign up to some kind of American-led anti-China coalition in that part of the world. I mean, for a long time, you know, Kyrgyzstan, you know, was very close to the US. It had a very large air base that was supplying the operations in Afghanistan and that kind of thing. But even there, their kind of things have, you know, been dialed down a lot. But yeah, they want that little bit of autonomy, and the more they can get it, the better. But part of your question was, you know, are the Brits and the Americans talking to each other on China policy? Yes, absolutely, very closely. But I kind of think the way that people are looking at China now, they're thinking, well, the economy is looking a bit ropey. Lots of, you know, this isn't the time that they're going to suddenly take their foot off the pedal. You know, they're going to hope that things will get, you know, more uncomfortable for the Chinese leadership, and that they will, you know, therefore be willing to tone down their behaviour in other ways. So there's lots of things that the Americans want from the Chinese. It's not clear whether the Chinese are going to be willing to give it to them.
Well, let's move along only somewhat, because while Cameron has been visiting Central Asia, Prime Minister, as of this broadcast, etc., Rishi Sunak has been visiting Germany, where the Chancellor has urged the United Kingdom to vastly step up its defence spending. How times change. Germany, having been jolted from its slumbers by Russia's assault on Ukraine 2 years and change ago, is at last poised to clear NATO's target of spending 2% of GDP on defence. Sunak has stated an ambition of bumping the UK's defence spending up to 2.5% by 2030, but as he and doubtless Scholz well know, current pre-election polling suggests that Sunak could have meant by 2030 this evening, for all the difference he will be able to make. Terry, why is Olaf Scholz taking this meeting? Is he just being polite at this point?
Well, I think, again, we were talking about, you know, areas that have been neglected, and, you know, Rishi Sunak hasn't been to Germany yet. You know, he's been there a couple of years. I think it's, you know, about high time that you got round to having a meeting at this level. And yes, obviously, they've got a lot to talk about. You know, they've got a lot in terms of defence to talk about. And yeah, it seems, you know, it's obviously a good thing for both sides. And, you know, yes, Scholz might be having a look, sort of one eye looking ahead to who else he might be meeting with, you know, in a few months' time in Britain. But, yeah, I think everyone seems to be just slightly trying to engage a bit more. Maybe they've been forced to do it, you know, by worrying about what's about to happen, what's been happening in Ukraine. But I think, you know, it's catching up.
Bill, the understaffing and under-equipping of the UK's armed forces has been a hardy perennial for as long as I can remember. It is weirdly counterintuitive, because the UK clearly enjoys thinking of itself as a great military power. I mean, granted, I think that idea of itself is largely rooted in World War II, possibly more accurately in World War II movies. But why is the UK always so reluctant to spend money on actually being a great military power?
Well, I'm not sure that it's that. It's more that, you know, that I guess the cost of kit is going up, the cost of people is going up. And, you know, there's a massive squeeze on public spending. When you actually pull down a lot of, you know, as ever with government announcements, you know, when it comes to, you know, if you look at the detail of the 75 billion that's been proposed, it looks more like 20 billion actually, when you take, you know, into account what's already been committed and that sort of thing. And it's just, it's a, you know, I guess at a time coming up to a general election, you know, you don't want to kind of, you know, put money into that kind of thing when there are people sort of hollering for tax cuts and other domestic spending priorities. But, you know, it's clear, I think, that the, you know, the British state as a whole, the government, the civil service has changed the way it's going to think about security, you know, and I think a Labour government will follow suit on this. And so there is going to be an increase in defence spending. But I mean, the contrast with, say, you know, what was happening, you know, just before the Russian invasion of Ukraine, when Britain was at the forefront of, you know, sending weapons and being a major contributor. And it seemed that all the states of the EU were being very slow. That has, you know, albeit slowly, has now changed. And, you know, Germany is far in front of the UK in terms of the amount of aid that it's providing. And I think part of this is a fear about what's going to happen in November in America. You know, is President Trump going to win the election? Is he going to do, you know, something that, you know, disables NATO in some way, and are Europeans going to be therefore having to sort of step up to the plate? So, you know, that's something that will basically, I think, a lot of European policy making now is sort of half on the assumption that Trump is going to win.
Terry, I understand what Bill's saying there about spending on defence in straitened circumstances, because obviously for any government there's things you have to pay for that you definitely know you are actually going to need, and the whole point ideally of a defence force is that you're never going to actually need it. It's a thing you build up in the hope that you will never have to call on it. But another pet theory, is it just as well a factor that island countries such as this think of defence a little bit differently? It seems less urgent when there's no imaginable threat just over the border. Is there still perhaps that idea of Neville Chamberlain's, that it's all a faraway conflict between people of whom we know nothing?
Yes, I think there possibly is that. But it's been quite interesting over the last few weeks. And I don't think this has run from Downing Street. I think you had a lot of current and former defence ministers saying, we need to spend more money. We need to think about air defences. We need to think about the fact that we haven't actually got a current plan for what we would do if there were a war, and that hadn't been updated for decades. And so there obviously is a certain amount of pressure of people saying, look, we need, you know, we probably won't have to use these things, but at least we need to be thinking about them. And as well, you've had quite a few sort of public utterances from members of, you know, the defence forces saying, look, you know, our ships aren't working, our missiles aren't firing, various other things are going wrong. So there seems to be quite a campaign building against, you know, the constraints of wanting to do tax cuts, wanting not to spend too much money, to say, look, you know, if there comes to another emergency that we can't quite yet foresee, we might not be ready for it. And I think that partly is what Sunak's responding to.
Bill, do we have to factor in just straightforward ineptitude as a possible reason for this? Another fun fact for you. Despite the shortfall in staff, it is nevertheless the case that 137,000 people applied to join the British Armed Forces last year. Fully 74,000 of them gave up because the recruitment process is too long.
And do we know why? We know because it was outsourced. Mm. And so in the olden days, you would go and see a man or woman who used to be in the army, who worked sort of for the army or was a reservist, and they would sort of sign you up. These days, it's outsourced to a private company whose website doesn't work very well and that kind of thing. And so, you know, and then people are sort of told, OK, you've passed the first round, hang on for a few months. And then they think, oh, I've got a job in a, you know, in a bar or something, and I quite like it, and I've got some people here. Oh, maybe I won't join the army after all.
And they've got too many tattoos and you can't join because of that. I think that was another problem.
You can now have a beard in the army. They changed that rule quite
recently.
That'll
encourage all the 17-year-olds to apply, I'm sure.
Just before we move off this one, Terry, there is possibly something else Sunak and Scholz could usefully be talking about, which is that both countries have recently experienced scandals or uproars of one sort or another pertaining to Russian and Chinese spying.
Yes. I mean, you know, I think that's obviously not something they're going to be discussing, you know, for our consumption.
Probably not at
the press conference. Yes. Anything else you'd like to tell us about that? But yeah, it's certainly sort of a concern for both sides. And, you know, both sides have got, like, for instance, I mean, the Germany on the far right, they've got now MEP allegations that his aide been spying for China. And I mean, I don't think this is yet at the sort of Willy Brandt, Günter Guillaume levels. This is not, you know, at as high a level as far as we know yet. But I think, you know, people will be worried about that, and they will be sort of wanting to think about, you know, what they can do. You know, again, there's that balance of how do we deal with China, or do we start seeing Chinese spies under the bed everywhere? Is that a big problem? Or, you know, how big of a concern is this exactly?
Well, at which we will move along slightly from incumbent leaders meeting each other to former and perhaps future leaders meeting each other. During his current travails in New York City, Donald Trump has found time, between whining about the ambient temperature in the courtroom, to meet controversial former Japanese Prime Minister Taro Aso. Yes, the inept blowhard with a wretched history of unsavory statements about Jews, Hitler, China and women who has sauntered through life thanks to inherited wealth, met Taro Aso, works just as well the other way around. Others who have recently solicited or endured Trump's company include Polish President Andrzej Duda and the aforementioned Lord Cameron. Terry, there's not necessarily anything actually wrong with this, is there? I mean, a lot of recent high-level political figures visiting the United Kingdom have wanted to have a quick chat with Sir Keir Starmer on the assumption that they'll be talking to him as Prime Minister next time they're in town.
Well, yes, exactly. And I think particularly if you're looking at Trump, you know, part of the game there is the flattery. It's making him feel important. You know, you go to visit him in Mar-a-Lago and, you know, rather than just relying on intelligence. And I think diplomats, people will probably want to say, you know, how is he actually doing? What is he looking like? What is he saying? And I think you're only going to get that kind of understanding by actually going and meeting him in person.
Bill, how careful do you have to be with the optics, though? I mean, I think it's fairly clearly understood why Cameron went to visit Trump. It was to try and keep him on track vis-a-vis Ukraine, should, by some calamitous mischance, he be elected again in November. But you do run the risk of perhaps aiding his election campaign by lending him that legitimacy and that gravitas, especially arguably by going to visit him at home?
Yeah. And I mean, I think, you know, Cameron's mission was to try to unblock Ukraine aid here and now, whereas I think Taro Aso's mission is about preparing for a Trump administration. And he's not, you know, he's whatever he is, chair or deputy chair of the Liberal Democrat Party in Japan. This is not a freelance operation. He has gone, you know, as an emissary of Japan, you know.
The Japanese are trying to style it out as a private visit, but I don't think anyone's buying that.
I mean, the Japanese, you know, played Trump, you know, or worked with Trump very astutely the first time round. And you know, they were the first out of the blocks, if I remember rightly, and, you know, they came to visit him, and they kind of, they didn't do the, oh, shock, horror, who is this man who's taken over? They basically said, this is the guy who's going to be running America. We've got to get close with him. And clearly they're starting that early. I mean, there is a sense among American Asia watchers that if Trump wins, it could be, in a kind of policy sense, a bloodbath for American policy in Asia. Mm. You know, the first time he elected, he didn't think he was going to be elected. He took a very long time to get his people in place, to get his policies straight. This time, he knows how the system works. He's got people there. He's got grudges to settle. And so I think everybody now is, you know, kind of investing time in getting close to Trump in the hope of trying to sort of, you know, steer his policy in certain directions, to maintain the alliance between the US and Japan being an obvious example.
Terry, during Trump's first term, there were various other national leaders who quite fancied themselves as a Trump whisperer, somebody who could actually have a conversation with him, steer him in the right direction. President Emmanuel Macron of France, most obviously, the even more obvious answer is President Vladimir Putin of Russia. But if he is re-elected, if we do have Trump again, and as Bill suggested, he might be better organized, all the available evidence is that he will also be more unhinged. Is there anybody on the current global stage who strikes you as the kind of person who might be able to throw a rope around him?
Well, it's difficult. I mean, it's interesting looking at Europe and how they're sizing it up. So obviously you've got people like Orban in Hungary, again, going to visit Trump in Florida and very much sort of styling himself in that manner. And you just remember that photo of sort of Angela Merkel, I think it was, when they were all at a summit and sort of Trump is sitting there and they're all surrounding him and talking to him like that. And I think you can see, you know, Macron with nothing to lose and sort of two more years until he's going to be out is going to want to set himself up as somebody who's standing for Europe as opposed to Trump. And he's got this new kind of sense of, you know, I'm saying it how it is in terms of foreign policy. So I think he would probably try to do that. And I think Trump would probably react quite badly to it. You know, because, so like, who's this little Frenchman telling me what to do? So I don't know who could actually, you know, persuade Trump. And I don't know how persuadable he would be.
Well, to something completely different, a hospital emergency room is by definition a somewhat fraught environment, a condition unlikely to be ameliorated in the slightest by the presence of a live snake. This seems not to have occurred to vexing numbers of patients presenting at Australian hospitals suffering snake bites, far too many of whom, for the liking of doctors and nurses, are bringing the snake with them. Reflecting on a recent such incident at Bundaberg Hospital, on the coast of Queensland, involving an eastern brown snake in an unsecured plastic container, one local Sawbones dryly offered that, "We want people to be able to get seen and assessed quickly, and having a live snake in the department slows up that process. The snake bitten are therefore being reassured that staff can glean all they need to know from the wound. Again, we repeat, don't bring the damn snake." Bill, first of all, snakes in general are a polarizing creature. People tend to have fixed views one way or the other. Where are you on snakes?
Well, since I live in Britain, I'm fairly, you know, kind of, you know, sanguine about snakes. But I did check the Bundaberg Wildlife Society website before I came here, and apparently there are 37 different varieties of poisonous snake in Bundaberg.
So the idea that
you could sort of take one in, and they go, "Hang on, is that the common brown or the lesser brown? You know, whatever it is."
Yeah. Have you, Terry, ever seen an actual snake for real in the wild up close?
Yeah. I mean, well, it's in Florida recently, and there were definitely snakes around snakes in the grass. And yeah, in the States, various ones. I mean, you know, American friends go, "Oh, yeah, that's a rattlesnake. Yeah, that's no problem. Don't worry about that." And you're like, "Oh, okay. Yeah, if you say so." So
I spent some time when I was living in Myanmar, and I was working upstairs one day in the house, and I had this tremendous thump and bash, and I went downstairs and my housemate had leapt on top of the sink because there was a snake in the kitchen, and we chased it out, and it was you knew that when the rains came they filled up the snake mm-hmm. holes and all the snakes came out, and that was generally a bad time to go walking around in the grass.
See, I am astonished by the fact that this appears to be happening reasonably regularly, because having grown up in Australia and having grown up in a lot of areas where there were lots and lots of snakes, I was told by my parents from a very, very young age, don't try to make friends with them, don't play with them, don't pat them, don't poke them with sticks, just leave them the hell alone, and they will doubtless extend you the same courtesy. So I wanted to ask you again, each in turn, before we get on to advice about dealing with wildlife, have either of you ever actually been injured in any way by actual wildlife?
My son got stung by jellyfish. Yeah, jellyfish in Italy, which there are a lot of them.
You've been stung by jellyfish.
That's not count. You know, the Italian lifeguards are brilliant. They just come along, give you some magic spray, and go, right, off you go. No, scorpions I've avoided being. Touch wood, I think I've been fine.
Nothing more than a bee sting.
Nothing more than a bee sting. I have a scar on my left hand that was put there by a kookaburra for by means by which I...
You mean you didn't listen to your parents? Well, they didn't mention the kookaburras.
They said don't make friends with snakes. They did not say anything about kookaburras. I blame my parents. But
Was it sitting in an old gum tree?
it was sitting in a fig tree, and my brother and I tried to entice it down to sort of be friends with us by putting meat on the ends of our hands, and this one particular kookaburra tried to make the swoop without stopping and perching adorably on our wrist as we had intended. They did eventually get to that point, except it then got to the point where they would just do it without you expecting to, and that can really freak you out if you're trying to mow the lawn and a kookaburra decides to try landing on your head and you're not expecting it to do that. But we did also want to ask, have either of you been presented with any notably useless advice about dealing with wildlife? Because growing up in Australia, I was presented with useful advice, i.e., leave it alone. But I was also once told by my uncle the most useless advice I've ever been given, not just about wildlife, but about anything, which is that the jaws of crocodiles, which we have in the Northern Territory, where my uncle had lived, the muscles that close their mouths will apparently take a human leg off, but the muscles that open their mouths are apparently very weak. So if confronted by a crocodile, the thing to do is to seize it by the snout and hold its mouth shut. Now, can either of you guess what my follow-up question to my uncle was?
What do you do next?
That was exactly it. And now what? I have a ton and a half of prehistoric death machine grasped in my fist. Talk me through the next move. Have either of you ever been given advice anywhere near that useless?
I think there's the one about scraping venom out with a credit card that I think probably doesn't work. I've also heard that apparently if dogs are fighting or a dog has bitten you, if you grab the dog by the tail and pull it upwards, it will automatically... it'll be so surprised that it will let go and go, open its jaws.
Something of a high-risk
sounds really dangerous to me. Yeah.
Because more seriously, for any listeners in snake-infested regions, Australian medicos are also saying don't apply a tourniquet, don't cut the wound. For the love of God, don't try to suck the venom out of it or ask anybody to do so, and please, please, please do not bring it into our emergency room. Bill, have you ever been given advice less useful than that?
No, I think someone told me that was a bit about the dog thing. If you try and push their eyes or something when a dog is biting you, that I don't think I'd be, have a presence of mind to try and poke a dog's eye that it was sort of, had its jaws wrapped around my leg or something like that. Anyway.
And we just wish to finish by saying that Monocle Radio does not encourage poking dogs in the eye. That was entirely the opinion of Bill Hayton, husband of the Labour candidate for Colchester.
An animal lover.
Bill Hayton and Terry Stiassny, thank you both for joining us. Finally, on today's show, when we think about the rise of artificial intelligence, we often believe that the world of food and drink won't be untowardly affected. After all, making the perfect beef bourguignon or brewing the perfect shot of espresso are artisanal crafts that machines won't be able to replicate entirely. But the industry should not shy away from consulting AI every now and then, because the results can be surprising, as witnessed by the Helsinki-based coffee roaster Kaffa. Monocle's Petri Bertsov reports.
Helsinki Coffee Festival, the largest coffee event in the Nordics, saw the launch of an entirely new blend of coffee. Called AI-conic, the blend was developed by the Helsinki-based artisanal roaster Kaffa together with the local consultancy Elev with the help of artificial intelligence and language models. Here is Elev's Antti Merilehto explaining how the coffee was born.
There was not a robotic mouth that was tasting. We actually used the taste notes by people, and then we started the process from there. We took the taste notes of those, and we gave it to the machine, to the language model. And then we started asking, these are the taste notes, these are the beans that people really like. What would be something new? Be inventive. We gave the role to be very inventive assistant to the roaster.
While I was talking to Merilehto, Kaffa's head roaster Mike Atkins was grinding beans and setting up his Chemex to give us a taste of the AI coffee.
When you saw the results of the language model and AI suggested, hey, these are the flavor profiles and notes that would be a really interesting new coffee. What was your initial reaction when you saw it?
Yeah, I mean, initially, like Antti said, we're always we kind of separate our origins into, you know, singular tastes. You know, Brazil has this flavor, Guatemala, Colombia, Ethiopia, and we try to highlight those. But it's quite often that you will find two particular beans that work really well together. To, you know, highlights. Brazil has quite low acidity, so if you want to like have some nice fruitiness with like a much higher acidity, you can add Ethiopian or Colombian or something like that. So it's something that we kind of usually put them in smaller pieces. So then, yeah, definitely, like when we first saw it, we were thinking like, okay, maybe this is going to be too many coffees. You'll just get kind of run over, and you won't really be able to taste any one super well. The way we do it is we always make blind cuppings, because I think in tasting it's really important to not let your biases get in the way. So we did like some of our own combinations of basically gave us this recipe of Brazil, Colombia, Guatemala, and Ethiopia. We did a few different rounds of testing with like different percentages of everything, like singular, like, you know, each bean individually, and then a mix, and then two and two. And then when we tasted them all blind at the end, we kind of just realized that like, hey, this one with all four has like a really good balance and a really good like taste profile.
Next, it was time to get a taste of this new AI blend.
Oh, nice. It's very very balanced, very easy to drink, but still not boring. It has character. Exactly. Just really pleasant coffee to drink, actually.
It's really nice. And I think we went through a little bit about roast level. And in Scandinavia, for our like single origin stuff, we tend to roast really like as light as we can roast it. And I think that is fine in real specific cases. But then this one, we wanted to push it a little bit more. The development really like highlights sweetness. And Colombia in particular, and Guatemala in particular, have really, like, they're super sweet and really like kind of fruity coffees. So when you just push them a little bit more, the sweetness gets highlighted, and it complements the Brazil. Brazil is very like nutty, cashew flavors, and like a really nice, like, with almost like, if you compare two coffees, you could say that Brazil almost has no acidity. Like, it's so soft. So when you put those two together in this roast level, I think it's really nice. And then I think, to me, the most interesting thing that comes out is you get these, like, more like, they're not, it's not like a constant flavor, but it's like at the end or in the smell is the Ethiopian, like, and that's the, like, more like a tea-like. Because, like, Ethiopian coffees are known to be really tea-like. If you roast them too dark, they're not so tea-like anymore. But this one, I think it came out really well. I think it's great.
Both Atkins and Merilehto are keen to see how artificial intelligence will shape the art of coffee making in the future. Both agree that humans will continue to play an important role, but that roasters should not be afraid of consulting with the AI every now and then.
We taste so much coffee that we have like really strong opinions all the time about this person likes this coffee and that person doesn't like this coffee. So yeah, I think that's the probably for me, and that'll be in like if I think about using AI in any of the roasting parts or the rest of the kind of coffee world, that would be the one thing that I think it can definitely do, just kind of break you out of your old habits and then start you on a new like just give you a new idea to try, and you're oftentimes really surprised. Even though we know that we're going to be surprised always, we always think like, oh yeah, we know what we're doing. We've done this millions of times. And I mean, yeah, it's nice to be wrong though, for sure.
For Monocle in Helsinki, I'm Petri Burtsov.
Thanks, Petri. And that is all for this edition of the Monocle Daily. Thanks to our panellists today, Terry Stiastny and Bill Hayton. The show was produced by Chris Chermak and researched by Gunnar Gronlid. Our sound engineer was Flynn Simons, with editing assistance from Steph Chungu. I'm Andrew Muller here in London. The Daily returns at the same time tomorrow. Thanks for listening.